Hey, this is Evan Phillips from Anchorage, Alaska, and you're listening to Short Ropes on the Fern Line. Alaska, the highest concentration of big, remote mountains in North America. For generations, a unique group of climbers have tested themselves in these vast alpine arenas. The Chugach, St. Elias, the Hayes, Neocola, the Kachatnas, the Revelations. Their stories are etched on high alpine walls. Their visions follow lines of cold gray ice. What inspires them? What makes them come back? Who survives? Who suffers? These are the stories we'll tell on Season 1 of The Fern Line. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 1, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of what's possible in Alaska's mountains and beyond. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in one of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. On today's episode, we'll revisit my conversation with legendary Alaskan alpinist Carl Tobin and listen to some outtakes that didn't make it on the last episode. But before we get started, I want to remind folks that if you enjoy what you hear on The Fern Line, there's a few simple and easy ways you can help out. The first is to leave a review on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app. Reviews are a great way to let potential listeners know that the podcast is a quality listening experience. Another way you can help out is by simply telling someone. Word of mouth is the best way to get information out there, and it helps create the grassroots vibe I'm going for. So make sure you tell a friend. I want to give a shout out to a few Fernline listeners: Bob Kaufman, Dustin Rule, Alex Sharmaz, and Harrison Alger. And I apologize if I mispronounced anybody's name. But anyways, these folks have reached out with feedback about the show or just to say hi, so I wanted to say thanks for taking the time to message me, and thanks for supporting The Fern Line. Finally, I want to mention that I'll be heading down to Utah in October, and I'm looking to do a few interviews while I'm there. So if you have suggestions or know someone that might have a good story to tell, drop me a line at thefernline@gmail.com and let me know what you have in mind. All right. So with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line. I've always been intrigued with the old-school climbers, the pioneers, the ones who pushed the boundaries of climbing and exploration, particularly in Alaska. Carl Tobin certainly fits into the category of a pioneer. His climbs in Alaska's remote Hayes Range raised the bar for hard alpine climbing in North America in the late 70s and early 80s. His climb up the Valdez test piece, Wowie Zowie, is an honest grade 6 climb even today, and was way ahead of its time when he made the first ascent in 1981 with the late Andy Embick. But like most alpinists, Tobin wasn't always at the leading edge of climbing. In fact, when he moved to Fairbanks in the early 1970s, he wasn't even a climber yet. I asked Carl to talk about his early days in Fairbanks, what the community was like back then, and how he eventually found his way into the mountains of Alaska.
Pretty laid back. There was a climbing community there that, because I was interested in climbing. I wasn't a climber when I moved up there, really. I bought a rope. But it was, the school was great. The community was great. But the climbing community didn't attract me a whole lot for some reason, interestingly.
So you weren't a climber when you came up. Had you ever done any climbing? At all?
No, some steep scrambling, maybe on a spring break out in Colorado, getting almost ledged out or, nearly wanting a rescue at least, or maybe wanting a rescue and not having one a couple of times. And, just sort of adventuring. And in southern Indiana, there's some cliffs you can, get yourself into deep shit on in 100 feet of space. So, I was just bumbling around in that sort of sense.
Okay. So what was your first climbing experience in Fairbanks or when you were in Fairbanks?
It could have been some ice climbing, because both of these maybe happened at the same time, and I wouldn't say, one was 6 months before the other. Fox and Dragonfly Creeks near Healy are places where, at that time anyway, Fairbanksians would go down and learn how to climb steep, short pitches of ice and granite tors and grapefruit rocks, which I'm sure you've heard of, were same places to go see if you could get up that line or this line or those sorts of things. Sometimes top roping, but generally trying to lead.
So you get it, you're starting to try climbing out a little bit, and this would be like the mid-70s then?
Yeah, like 74, 75.
Okay, yeah, about the year I was born. What were some of the influences you had back then? Did you end up meeting like a small posse of friends, or were you just kind of doing your own thing?
Well, yeah, it was a posse of friends. My friend Cliff Moore and I were pretty tight partners for a while. Yeah, that first spring break in Fairbanks, so it would have been, March. It was in March of 74. Cliff and I and a guy named Bob Toombs, a guy named Brian Quackenbush, and Ann Gunderson, and Joff Carroll. I don't think I said Joff's name yet. He's a fishing game biologist in Barrow now. We rolled out of town to climb Mount Sanford over spring break. And four of us were successful. Anne ended up not going in. Actually, she went halfway in and got a little ill, so she camped and down in the woods and turned around and actually skied out eventually. And I didn't make the summit because I had frozen my toes. But I did snowshoe on crampons to what we called the Nunatak, a 13,000-foot little peak, when the other guys were going to the summit. And we were a week overdue getting back, and there was a low-level search had begun for us probably a day before we got to the road.
Okay, so that sounds like it was a pretty learning experience for sure, huh?
I guess. I'm not sure what I learned. Certainly, there's nothing technical on the climb.
Yeah.
So, you don't learn much about that, but you sure learn that the weather could pin you down for long periods of time. And in retrospect, I think we all learned that we could have been much more comfortable during the storm.
How so?
Could have built a palatial cave instead of staying in a tent. Yeah. I think.
So you did learn some stuff.
Oh, yeah.
In my late teens, my dad gave me a copy of the book, In the Shadow of Denali. A mountaineering classic, this collection of short stories tells the gripping tales of a unique group of people that live their lives on and around the Haiwan. Some of the characters in the book, climbers like Mug Stump, inspired me to push myself in the mountains, while others, like the hard-drinking Herb Atwater, brought tears to my eyes and forced me to ponder the harsher realities of Alaska. But the most intriguing story followed the life of Johnny Waterman, a brilliant but tortured alpinist who lived in Fairbanks, Alaska in the 1970s. His 4.5-month siege and first ascent of the Southeast Spur on Mount Hunter in 1978 might be the most audacious solo in the history of alpinism. But it also showcased a darker side, and by the early 80s, Waterman was slipping into a delusional madness that would ultimately kill him. That's why I was fascinated when Carl told me he'd been friends with Johnny, even making an unsuccessful attempt with him on Mount Deborah in 1975. I asked Carl to talk about his relationship with Waterman and the legacy he left behind.
Well, he was intense. He was, I'm fairly sure, I don't know exactly what his diagnosis is because I haven't read, you know, he was in API once. You know, I visited him there a couple of times and probably had some schizophrenia or something. He was a very intense guy, very organized, meticulous, almost to a fault sometimes. Not seeing the forest for the trees, he was that way. Very lonely guy, probably because he was so odd, maybe. Always felt, he seemed like he always felt he was an outsider. I spent quite a bit of time visiting with him before he flew into Hunter. And, he was baking his Logan bread and all that. And, I think that was in 81. And I remember I was in Yosemite when I heard that he had disappeared.
So, I mean, were you guys close friends or were you just kind of buddies or?
God, did Johnny have any close friends? Life Norman Patterson was a good friend of Johnny's, I think, who was a British Columbia climber. We didn't socialize particularly together, if that's the case. I would see him often, though, and we would visit each other some. Yeah. Even when he was getting ready to go into Hunter, I was over his house several times as he was prepping and baking lots of Logan bread.
What did you think at the time, like when you were kind of watching him go through this stuff? Like, what was your perspective on it?
Oh, well, like on Deborah when he had his meltdown. He did have a meltdown on Deborah, which was, at that point in time, I was pretty green, and but even then I realized that failure in the mountains can extract a hard price on people, and it has extracted, I would say, a hard price on me a couple of times. That failure was in 75 on Deborah. I was probably the weak link in the chain of that group of three of us. Particularly the gear I had, Pretty much probably would have frozen my feet summoning Deborah.
Yeah.
So I could see Johnny being frustrated with me, but he never held anything like that against me. But yeah, Johnny was, he was a different person. Yeah, way different person. And I think after 75, that's a lot, maybe the last time he climbed with anyone.
Wow.
Possibly.
Wow. What were your feelings when he disappeared?
Well, I have to think back, but he certainly, I don't think, was the... I know he wasn't the first person that I knew personally that died climbing. So you get to accept that, not nonchalantly, but when he disappeared, I talked to people that I knew who had been in the Ruth and seen him. And people thought he was on a suicide mission, you know, and I think that could be true, but I think he was... more on a mission that I would probably maybe label close to suicidal on that particular trip. And there's a difference there. Yeah, I don't think he committed suicide. And he had a lot of people in his life that really, I think, not a lot maybe, but cared about him. And, you know, Cliff Hudson was one for sure.
What was the community's response after he passed away or after he disappeared?
Well, in an immediate sense, I'm not sure, you know, because I probably didn't get back to town for 2 weeks in terms of the immediate aftermath. But, you know, the Alaska Alpine Club, the Alaskan Alpine Club, actually, you know, the Buchanan Club, which we all called the Buchanan Club because, you know, Doug sort of made that club and kept it together, kept it going, Doug Buchanan. You know, started a Waterman Memorial Climbing Grant. That's still administered today by the people in the club. I'm still in the club.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's still a functioning club.
That's really cool.
Didn't die with Doug. President is a guy named Jeff Keener. So, you know, Johnny left a legacy in the climbing community there.
It's interesting and a unique perspective to kind of hear your story about interacting with him and getting to do that trip with him and...
Yeah, well, yeah, it's, you know, you look back in your life and you go, well, that was, you know, useful or occupied me in a way that I consider personally my life useful anyway. And, yeah, those early days back in the mid-70s through the early 80s were tremendous days.
Most experienced alpinists eventually have a close call in the mountains. For some, it can be as insidious as a simple slip on steep ground. For others, it can be as sobering as a bowling ball-sized rock whizzing an inch from their helmet. For Carl, it came in 1984 when an avalanche in the Hayes Range nearly killed him. Although he was able to be rescued from the mountains, he was left with serious injuries and psychological wounds to heal. I asked Carl to describe the accident and talk about what it took to recover.
Well, what happened was pretty simple. I was with a fellow named Matt Van Inkevort, a Fairbanks born and raised guy, very competent out in the mountains. I think Matt, nowadays he's a CEO of a bike company, actually, Marin Bicycles. And I had been working all summer, you know, I was kind of obsessed with climbing in those days. I mean, really obsessed, not to the exclusion of all else, but I had been working for a glaciologist in Greenland all summer for months through some good climbing times. And we came back, didn't get back to the country until maybe early September, and I had set up a climb to do, which is maybe a little late September to go in the Alaska Range. And there are winter conditions in there and slab conditions. And a peak called 9448, really pretty little peak. And the north face was inclined. I wanted to climb it. So we went in there and got on some really steep ground. And the weather started going south. It was nice climbing, though. So we left our two ropes on top of each other, and rappelled down. And then down climbed the gullies until one of them slabbed on me and sent me to the glacier, well over 1,000 feet lower.
And sounds like a really close call.
I didn't expect to live through it when it started. You know, I had a fairly fatalistic conclusion instantaneously, like, I'm going to die this time. But as Mike Tyson says, everyone has a plan till they get hit. And right after that plan, I got hit by something and didn't remember a thing until I regained consciousness at the bottom sometime later.
Yeah. Physically, what happened to you?
I had some punctures through my cheeks and a broken rib, and my legs were very damaged. Left femur was broken in two places. And the right tibia had been plateaued, which is a break you get when your femur rams into your tibia and smashes it. And all the ligaments were torn off of that knee as well.
So how'd you get out of there?
My partner was still alive and down climbing while I was a heap at the bottom. So Matt came down and, you know, did it all. Dragged me out onto the off the debris, out onto the glacier, and moved our camp over to me. Dragged me into the camp. Then it was dark then, so we sat through the night, smoked a couple bowls, and when it got light, Matt took off. And I'm not sure exactly how long it was until he ran into a camp of moose hunters who had a radio. You know, down in the woods, quite a ways down. It was well over 24 hours, I think. And they called in the fact that there was an avalanche victim in a tent at the base of this mountain. And Roman and Cliff, both of them I've mentioned, a guy named Don Logan, another guy named Jim Art. There were no PJs in the state room. There was an Alaska Mountain Rescue Group that Doug had kind of organized. People that keep, you know, food and gear ready to go. Just in their house, and they get a call. And so they got flown in by the National Guard and dropped off way down the glacier because the weather was fucked. You couldn't see, I don't know how much you could see because I was mostly in the tent, but when I had to throw my shit out the door of the tent, you know, lots of snow would come in. You know, there was nothing, it was just howling, screaming. You know, I'd shit on the pad because I couldn't move. You know, I'd pick up the shit and throw it out the door. I didn't shit a lot because I wasn't eating a lot, but you know. So it was a nasty condition, and you know, Roman tells the story of was skiing up, because Roman had been there before. We had climbed Hess a couple times before, and had been in right in that same area, and he kind of knew where to look. But I was lucky he found me, because he said there was that much of the tent left out. I mean, I had a frustratingly hard time of trying to keep the tent from getting buried because I couldn't dig, and knew I was going to die if the tent got buried and wasn't visible. So I was fairly frustrated. And so the last time that my last dig out, you know, I take the shovel blade and cinch the tunnel door around my arm and try to dig, but more snow was coming in than going out in that last event. There was only about that much tent left. So I shut the door, and I'd been pretty calm up until then, but then I cut loose with a blue streak, you know, just swearing at the top of my lungs. And I don't know for how long, like several seconds. And as soon as I stopped, someone said, "Carl." So there he was. You know, he paints a picture of being very, very lucky to find the tip of the tent sticking out.
Man, how much pain were you in?
I could feel the femur like grinding around when I'd sit up and down, but it wasn't, I didn't have much pain. Yeah, we had a pint of tequila that was that we had, you know, in base camp there. And I saved that pint for the sled ride. I knew if I got rescued and put in the sled, it wasn't going to be pretty. So I was in there and I had the full pint down by the time we got down to the where the chopper was. And, you know, if I hadn't been hurt badly, I wouldn't have gotten in the chopper in the weather conditions. You know, the guy was doing a heroic job of flying.
Yeah, I totally had forgotten you'd been in that accident. I mean, I knew about it a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, just because it had come up in a conversation or something. Uh-huh. But, man, that sounds like it really could have gone either way if certain...
I've had times on my bicycle sketching across the street where it could have gone either way sometimes, but that was a close call, I think. I mean, the fall should have killed me. I can't imagine many people living through it just because of the probabilities involved, you know? I was just lucky to live through the fall.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, there had to have been a recovery process. What was it? What did you go through psychologically after that?
I had some fear of faces, you know. I kept climbing. You know, the Chittistone trip was just not that long after that, a couple of years after that. And I went to Valdez and, you know, I might have soloed something big or something, you know, but I had an aversion to the mountains.
Yeah. So did your alpine climbing kind of taper off after that?
Well, yeah, it did. And all my climbing did eventually. You know, I had this, you know, the reason I learned to ice climb and pushed ice climbing and learned to rock climb and pushed rock climbing was because of alpine climbing. So alpine climbing kept it all together. And when it went away, so the rest of it. And then, I don't know, I started climbing again one day, though.
Well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Carl's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his immense alpine wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. Don't forget to review the podcast on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app, and don't forget to sign up on the email list at thefernline.com. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line.